This lecture is entitled Scientific Balance Training and was presented by Paul Check at the Canadian Association of Fitness Professionals Annual Convention in Toronto, August 2003.
Scientific Balance Training, a structured, I'll say that again, structured approach to developing long-term balance skills and development. Okay, not what's the latest craze, how can we keep the orthopedic surgeons busy with a cool balance board, structured development. This lecture is built off of my 6-part article series, which is available on the website www.ptonthenet.com. It's the most heavily traveled website in the world for exercise education. It's a membership site. It's not a free site, but I've got over 30 articles on there, some of them as big as 20,000 words, so you'll probably find it worth it if you have an interest in the type of articles that I write. There's enough to fill 2 or 3 binders on there. Okay, so if you want a more detailed explanation of what I'm going to give today with references, that's the place to go. The article series is much more technical than this lecture will be. All right. Well, the purpose of the cover slide there, the starting slide, is to show you that balance training really begins right from the start. Our goals today are to understand how segmental stabilization and gross stabilization and posture are prerequisites to developing long-term balance skills. I'm going to show you that there are several things that have to underlie balance skills development so that the balance skills last. We want to recognize that balancing is a skill. Because someone can perform complex balancing acts does not ensure that they have intrinsic segmental stability, nor does it correlate with reduced incidence of musculoskeletal dysfunction. For 20 years, I've been treating injured athletes, and I can tell you, I've got athletes that can do amazing balance feats. I work with world-famous motocross racers, world-famous skateboarders, world-famous skiers, all sorts of these people, and a lot of them can do amazing balance tricks, but they're in pain. So what I'm going to show you in this lecture is just because you can stand on top of 3 different kinds of wobble boards at once does not mean that you're functional. All it means is that you've learned how to stand on 3 wobble boards at once. And if you fall, you're probably going to hurt yourself. Okay? We must learn to prescribe balance-specific training based on an individual's needs for that client's intrinsic or internal environment, their internal physiology, and their external environment. For example, firemen are people in everyday situations that have to run through burning, smoking buildings, carrying screaming, kicking people while being dressed in heavy obstructive equipment. Those people could have intrinsic problems. They could have food allergies causing inflammation in their gut, shutting their stabilizer system down, which causes an intrinsic disorder that will disrupt their balance while dealing with an extrinsic or an external environment that is very challenging. So what I'm going to show you in this presentation is that we have to look at the internal environment as well as the external environment to decide what route we're going to take to improve that person's balance. We should not be using the latest fad techniques. Okay? I've had all sorts of people in my courses and seminars say, what about the such and such board? Shouldn't you be using that? I just took a course on that, and that works for everything. Well, great. How would you treat a hemorrhoid with it? Well, you know, it sounds funny, but I'm being serious. If you understand the biological oscillators and the biological pumps, one of the first things that happens to people who have a dysfunctional abdominal wall, especially women, is they start over-contracting the pelvic floor. I'll show you that in my Better Butt, Better Back lecture. And that constriction disrupts circulation, causes venous back pressure, and causes hemorrhoids, right? So, you know, I don't give a damn what tool you have. Do you know how to use it? Or are you just doing what the rest of the sheep are doing? That's what I'm here to try to pass on to you guys. We've got to stop doing sheep training and sheep conditioning because some manufacturer comes up with a gimmick and they want to convince you to use it for everybody, for everything, because the more you use it, the more they buy. The more you buy, the happier they are. All you got to do is walk into any gym. You see stuff cluttering the gym that is not only being used incorrectly, but shouldn't be there because it's garbage. Fad training, as you see in my books, is forthcoming anatomical dysfunction. That's what it is. Well, when we talk about balance, we better look at who our market is. Everybody loves to learn how to train world-class athletes. Oh, let's do all the cool stuff, right? What percentage of your clients are world-class athletes? Most of these people can't go to the toilet properly. They're tired all the time. They're lethargic. They're dull. And they're self-medicating with toxic stimulants just to keep their eyeballs awake at 5 in the afternoon. Right? And we're trying to do the latest crazy stuff to them. Well, look at some of the statistics. It's projected by the year 2045, there will be 77 million people older than 65, and one of every five will be 85 years of age or older. Right now, the population's aging. The baby boomers are here, man. And they're the people that can afford your services, but by the way. By age 74, about 50% of people have difficulty with common functional tasks, such as lifting, climbing, walking upstairs, bending, reaching, and grasping. And it is well known that the most common orthopedic injury amongst the elderly is what? Hip fractures. Why? Because they fall, especially in places like Northern America, where you have definite winters and there's icy steps and slippery this and slippery that. People fall and they fracture hips. I've worked with plenty of them. As a matter of fact, it is the number one cause of death amongst the elderly, fractured hips. And guess what is the primary modus of exercise for the elderly in almost every gym in the world? Almost every gym in the world that has an exercise program for the elderly, who can describe it to me? Chairs and machines. You go to the physical therapy clinics, they got a row of, I'm not supposed to say names in this conference, they told me I'm not allowed to do that. A row of this stuff. We'll just call it shit. That's ubiquitous. Clutters our gyms, and they put people on there in an environment where they don't have to balance anything, they don't learn anything, and they get a false perception of strength that makes them more willing to expose themselves to challenging tasks that they should not do. But in this lecture, I'll show you why that does not work. Orthopedic clinics are overflowing today with children, workers, and sportsmen suffering from injuries related to a lack of balance. And I don't just mean balance, I mean balance. Last year in the United States, there were over 100,000 anterior cruciate ligaments operated on. Don't you think that's interesting? How did we evolve and live in the wild with no doctors, no nutritionists, no nurses, no therapists? I mean, just us and the animals. And nobody operating on anterior cruciate ligaments. And all of a sudden, here we are with all of our super smart scientists and doctor this and pill that. And 100,000 people in one country had their knee operated on. We're degenerate. Our society is falling to pieces. And our scientists and our nutritionists and our doctors, and unfortunately, most of our exercise professionals are using techniques that are not helping us improve our capacity to survive. We're degenerating. If you don't need to look at studies from universities. All you got to do is look around. Look to your left, look to your right. There's your study. That's the only study your clients are paying you for, isn't it? Your clients don't pay you to hear about double-blind studies on the, you know, actin and myosin filaments of a frog from a local pond in a petri dish. Unless you're teaching them balance skills. Here you can see that mechanically and in nature, anytime you have to lift a larger load or you have a taller structure, you need an increased base of support. So the heavier the load and the longer the boom, the bigger the base of support must be. Fairly simple mechanics, right? I mean, you could shorten the base of support up, pick something that heavy up, thing and just fall right over. So when you're talking about something like a crane, in order to pick things up and move them, it has to be very stable. But that crane is not very mobile, is it? It's relatively immobile. This is important because you're going to see in the human body that if you increase stability too much in your training, you will detract from mobility. So if you're working with a gymnast and you have them do too many heavy deadlifts, that stiffens the body up. So it'll actually start detracting from mobility. So you have to look at each person's environment and sport to decide where is the optimal zone of stability relative to mobility. Just like an engineer has to calculate exactly how much base of support that crane has to have relative to that boom length, and what's the maximum load the crane operator can lift at any position of boom arc before that thing's unsafe, right? Well, if you use the same concept on a lot of the stuff we're doing to people in the gym, any engineer would look and say, that's a dangerous exercise the way you're doing it. But we just do it to people at random. Even Mother Nature is intelligent enough to know that when the height goes up, the base increases. Okay? So you can see it in engineering, and you can see Mother Nature's engineering. She knows that while that increases stability, it decreases mobility. That's not the position that animal would be in if it was threatened by a cat, is it? Couldn't move quick enough. But to relax and have a meal, that's a great energy efficient position. And that's also an ideal position to look around for something that might eat you. When I talk about segmental and gross stability, what I want you to understand is that segmental stability is a term used to refer to the ability to stabilize segments of the spine. So here you see the multifidus, which are the primary segmental stabilizers of the spine. You have other stabilizers like the intertransversiary and the interspinales, but these muscles are highly proprioceptive. They have minimal capacity to stiffen the system. The multifidus, along with the transverse abdominis and other muscles like the quadratus lumborum, are more suited to segmental stability. Your rotator cuff is a segmental stabilizing system for the glenohumeral joint. So throughout your body, you've got six rotator muscles around your hip. Their primary job is segmental stabilization at the hip. And then you have muscles in the body that function as gross stabilizers. So you've got the large latissimus dorsi that runs from T5 all the way down into the thoracolumbar fascia, right through across the sacrum, and merges into the opposite gluteus maximus. So you see the posterior oblique system. So the glutes, thoracolumbar fascia, and latissimus dorsi integrate the upper body and the lower body, the opposite arm with the opposite leg. And they not only are key prime movers, but they're gross stabilizers, right? If you are wrestling with someone and you grab them and they try to pull on you, your multifidus doesn't have a fighting chance of stabilizing your spine against something that gross. So what I'm telling you in a nutshell here is that while it's nice to be in conferences and hear lectures about the segmental stabilizers or the inner unit or the outer unit or this muscle does that, in reality, it's a system. The inner unit systems are useless without the outer unit systems. And the outer unit systems are useless without the inner unit systems because the outer unit systems will destroy the joints without the inner unit systems. And the inner unit systems stabilize the joints to give the outer unit system something to work upon. So they're married. They're like a Siamese twin. Two heads, one body. So just be careful about cutting things into nice little anatomical chunks because reality doesn't work that way. If your lat doesn't work, your inner unit doesn't work because your inner unit is married to the thoracolumbar fascia and the latissimus dorsi works to stabilize the thoracolumbar fascia. The latissimus dorsi is attached to the spine. The spine is stabilized by the inner unit, no lat. I can cut this thing up. You give me a muscle, I'll tell you how it's related to any joint, any function. That's my job. But the reality of it is, it's a system. And if the system doesn't work, guess what? The system doesn't work. Feldenkrais likened the body to three inverted triangles or pyramids stacked on one another. As you can see, a pelvic pyramid, a trunk pyramid, a head-neck pyramid. And as Feldenkrais said in many of his books, the body is inherently unstable, but it's a very mobile configuration. This is important because the human being has to be stable for some activities, but it's got to be highly mobile for others. So our body's designed to switch back and forth between immobility and dynamic capacity to stability and excessive stabilizing. Like, you don't want to do a heavy deadlift without being stable, or you'll get hurt. But you don't want to be in this position if you're going to try to move in any direction. You need to be more in a universal stance. Okay, so that the body's well designed for the tasks of being a human being in nature. You can here see by design, because human beings have minimal base of support, as demonstrated here, you can see the arc of the body, the center of gravity of the body is somewhere in here. And here, look how tiny the base of support is relative to the opposite configuration. This is highly stable, and that is highly unstable. Okay? And the human body can go from a stance like that to a stance like that. That's the dynamic capacity we have. But don't be foolish enough to think that just because somebody can do that, that they are well-balanced, that their spine is healthy, because I've had clinics full of people like that. Okay? My goal is to teach you, give you the concepts to investigate how to give people the ability to do that for their entire career without becoming injured. To achieve stability and mobility requires exquisite segmental and gross stability and fine motor control. Here you see Native African women out gathering, and look at the size of the pieces of wood. You know, some of these women will walk 5-10 miles with a chunk of wood like that on their head, and they will be beautifully balanced. They won't be working much harder than most of you would walking to this lecture, because they know how to use their body and they're not eating a bunch of crap from gyms that shuts off their stabilizer system due to visceral inflammation. Here you see in Mother Nature, a four-legged animal with tremendous stability becomes very unstable, yet has to have balance and skill to acquire food. So almost everywhere you see in the healthy organism a capacity to be stable or unstable for the needs of the organism. Remember, I said internal environment, external environment. These people are hunting for wood so they can cook and feed themselves. They're doing that for an intrinsic drive, and they have an extrinsic demand. So you look at the size of the mass of the load, and look, there's a woman on one leg. So you can see this is an engineering challenge. Remember we saw the crane earlier, big boom, picking up a heavy load, huge base of support. Here we see a woman carrying what could easily be 40% of her body weight on her head, which moves her center of gravity way up, probably into her chest at least, and she's on one leg. That just goes to show you how well engineered the human body is. 85% of the human gait cycle is performed on one leg. Most people don't realize that just walking is a phenomenal balancing act. And if you could see what I can see in aerobics classes and circuit classes and even spin bike classes and a lot of these things, you would see that a tremendous number of people going to your classes don't even have the stability to walk correctly, yet they're being exposed to very high impact exercises. Okay? So it's very important to realize when carrying any mass above your center of gravity, the stabilizer systems are progressively more challenged to subserve the mobilizer systems of the body. The stabilizers have to work in proportion to the demand on the mobilizers. A lot of balance and a lot of force requires a lot of dynamic stability, okay? So here you can see that in nature, triangles are always used. So if you look at the multifidus muscles, you can see that the multifidus muscles, which generally cross three, sometimes four segments, send fibers from the articular pillar or the mammillary process to the spinous process, just like that, up several segments. Look at all the triangles. You see all the triangles the engineers use? Because triangles and pyramids are very, very strong structures. So if you look at your spine, if you look at an anatomy book, you'll see that ligaments and many of your muscles relative to the bone structures create triangles all over the place. Your spine is very much like the boom of that crane, except your spine moves. That's a lot more technical to manage than that crane. Inner unit stiffness provides stability. But again, it's not that simple. That crane has to have a certain level of stiffness to provide stability. But it's real fixed. It's a block of metal. It's got cables. It's relatively simple. But this crane is extremely dynamic. So what you see here is what's classified as the inner unit, the diaphragm, the transverse abdominis, the pelvic floor, the deep muscles of the low back, the multifidus, which we just saw their triangular configuration. These muscles are all reflexively controlled so that if you activate any one of them, you'll feel the other ones activate. And that's easy to prove to you. I can prove it to you right here in your chair. If you take your finger and put it in your belly button, all you women know what a Kegel is, right? Guys, I'm going to ask you to lift your testicles, but not with your other hand, okay? Men just lift your testicles. Women do a Kegel and see what your belly button does when you do a Kegel or lift your testicles. Notice that your belly button automatically moves in, but you didn't think pull your belly button in, did you? That's because as soon as you activate any of the muscles in the inner unit, they automatically send a message through the spinal cord to all the other inner unit muscles to activate, because the brain has a reflex relationship with these muscles to activate and stiffen the spine. Okay? Critical information, because without any one of these muscles not working, it debilitates the whole system. And remember, I said the inner unit systems and the outer unit systems are like a Siamese cat. Okay? If one part doesn't work, the other part doesn't work. Two heads, one body. So what makes this system tricky is that while research by Richardson, Joel, Hodges, Hides, and others shows that when they do EMG studies on the inner unit muscles, it doesn't matter what direction you move an arm or a leg or how fast it goes, there is an inner unit contraction that precedes movement of the leg by 110 milliseconds and movement of the arm by about 30 milliseconds in a healthy body, and it is not movement specific. That's in the healthy body. But what I can tell you, hands down from clinical experience, is that That's just an activation. There's no necessary skill in activating. For example, lots of people can do a biceps curl, but that doesn't make them a good boxer. A lot of people can do a triceps extension, and that's part of the golf swing, doesn't make you a good golfer. What you've got to understand is that the activation of the inner unit is programmed into the brain based on each motor pattern that you use or learn for your given environment. So what I'm telling you is that some people, for example, cannot activate their inner unit properly throwing a ball, but they can bend over and pick up a dumbbell and their inner unit will work. Because if there is pain or faulty learning in any given pattern, it could shut the inner unit off, or if you were not taught to exercise correctly, you may not have integrated the inner unit into the pattern. So if you go back to the picture of the gymnast I showed you, if that gymnast is eating bread and she's allergic to gluten, which 50 to 60% of white-skinned people are, that creates inflammation in the intestinal tract. The inflammation of the intestinal tract reflexively shuts off the inner unit because the small intestine is innervated from T5 to T9, and it shares a reflex relationship with the entire abdominal wall. So any medical drug, food additive, preservative, or coloring, stress, or alcohol consumption that shuts off the gut by inflaming the intestinal wall, bacterial invasion, viral invasion, parasitic invasion, it will shut off the abdominal wall. This is why so many women, for example, can never flatten their lower abdominals. They've either got uterine inflammation or they've got dietary problems or both, as a couple of examples. So, but if that was the gymnast and she was eating Kellogg's cornflakes for breakfast and bread on her sandwiches, she could be shutting her abdominal wall off. Do you think it's going to stop her from going to gymnastics every day? No. She'll keep going, but she'll be keep going with a dysfunctional abdominal wall. And she'll be a 13-year-old girl that has terrible back pain, but is highly committed to gymnastics. And the doctors and therapists will constantly overlook this source of abdominal wall dysfunction. And she will develop balanced skills in gymnastics coaching in absence of a functional inner unit. Her skills in gymnastics will require a massive recruitment of the outer unit systems. And because the inner unit system is debilitated, it will cause rotational torque, compression and torsion and shear in the joints throughout her body, which will result in a string of chronic musculoskeletal injuries. So she'll be the typical athlete who performs great because she's intelligent, willing, able, and psychologically equipped for the sport, but physically hampered. That doesn't happen very often, no, does it? That's the norm, but it shouldn't be. I tell people all the time, if you want to learn how to be a good athlete, stop watching television, stop reading magazines, because everything they're telling you about how to eat and how to exercise in there is garbage. All you got to remember, you can't fire a cannon from a canoe. It's an old saying. I don't know who started it, but it makes a good point. Just remember, stabilization must precede force generation. You can't fire a cannon from a canoe. All you got to do to prove this to yourself is kneel on a Swiss ball and try to swing a golf club or swing a baseball bat. And because of the lack of stability created by the ball or a decreased base of support, you'll flip right off the ball unless you've got exquisite motor control. So here what I'm showing you is that we must work as exercise and healthcare professionals to progress people carefully and intelligently so that when we go to teach them motor skills for their work or sports environment, that they last and that they're not activating outer unit systems at the expense of pain-sensitive structures. In most functional activities that you do standing on your feet, there is a sequence of events. Stabilization almost always emanates from the core.